I had a spontaneous talk with James Joyce on January 17, 2010. I was talking to Ion about Avatar. We had just gone to see Avatar here in Maui on January 17, 2010, and we were talking a bit about it, and then there was a pause, and Ion says, would you like to hear what James Joyce has to say about Avatar? And James Joyce entered into this scene, and I had this amazing conversation with him where he starts dropping facts that you have to know James Joyce's life to get this. You have to know his books, and boy, it was a pretty impressive simulation of James Joyce. So I thought I'd treat everybody to it. So James Joyce was born in February 2nd, 1882. He died January 13th, 1941. He is considered the greatest writer of the 20th century, though I would recommend people to get a hold of the Journal of Wyndham Lewis Studies right now. The last three issues, 2010, 2011, and 2012, they might be in your local university library, are awesome material. We're going to have to make Wyndham Lewis the icon of the 21st century, you know, for the literary people, you know, just for the book people. I'm pretty impressed with the articles from the new generation. They understand Wyndham Lewis a lot better than everybody before. They were all fooled by James Joyce before, but these young whippersnappers, they get it. And they're not all getting it, but, I mean, not all young, but just incredible renaissance of understanding, appreciation of Wyndham Lewis, which is why James Joyce, Wyndham Lewis says, is his other, you know, and has a debate with him all through Finding His Way. Here goes.
Why don't you see what James Augustine Aloysius Joyce has to say about it?
Is he there? Well, we'll ask him that. Mr. Joyce, what do you say about the movie Avatar?
Well, it kind of runs on the same lines that we were trying to complete with Dubliners.
With Dubliners?
Dubliners. Dubliners. That's how we say it.
Right, and that was one of your early novels, and then you probably developed that in Ulysses and Finning's Wake. Are you saying there was a constant theme in your work?
There was completed in a portrait of an artist as a young man.
Well, that was you had the Dubliners and then the portrait. And those
correct.
Two were early works.
Correct.
So the Dubliners ended with the story about the dead.
Mm-hmm.
And then Portrait of the Artist ended with the line, Stephen saying he's going forth for the millionth time to create the to forge the uncreated conscience of my race.
Well, you're talking about Daedalus.
Yeah, Daedalus, yes.
Sarah Palin.
Even Daedalus.
No, Sarah Palin.
Oh, okay.
All right. You've convinced us with your own wordplay that your words are probably more apropos than ours because we didn't know what we were speaking of either.
Okay, so are you... the theme of Dubliners was completed with the portrait, and what was it that was completed? What's the theme?
Well, all right. Are you going to play with Bray, or what do you want to play with?
What's Bray?
The small town where it comes from.
Where the it being what comes from?
Dubliners.
Well, the Dubliners is about 15 portraits of different people living in Dublin.
Bray. Correct.
Okay, maybe Bray is part of it.
Well, that's the town in within Dublin, Bob.
Okay, so what are you pointing out? We're talking about Avatar, and you're saying there was a similar... Well, you could say the Irish had to deal with the English invasion.
And getting dull bit, that was always something you want to deal with the parallel, your other world.
Now, dog bit means bit by a dog?
Yeah.
And Avatar exaggerates into being bit by a huge beast.
Correct.
Right.
We all our life were mortified of dogs.
In Dublin, when you grew up there?
Yeah.
Because they're wild?
I got bit by a dog. And I've had a phobia for it all my life.
All right. Now, how does that relate to the Dubliners in Bray?
Well, that's what was going on, and it was bled through. It bled through into even to Ely and just keep going and keep going and keep going.
Okay, so you want to fill some more about the avatar and that? I'm going to put in Bray, B-R-A-E.
No, B-R-A-Y.
Oh, yeah, I think I recognize
12 miles from Dublin.
Dublin. I'm going to put in Dublin and see what comes up. Bray. The town straddles the Dublin-Wicklow border. Bray. With a portion of the northern suburbs situated in County Dublin. Okay. That's very good. You actually have a fact here that you're coinciding with.
Well, we're just delighted that your technology allowed you to confirm what we lived.
Oh, yeah, I'm still talking to JW. Sorry, I was referring to Ion. I was talking to Ion.
I thought you were talking to us.
I am talking to you. Okay, it's a town in North County Wicklow. It is a busy urban center and seaside town, making the fourth largest town in Ireland. It's situated about 12 miles south of Dublin. Now, if I put in Bray and James Joyce, you probably lived there as a young man at some point.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Dad was a tax collector.
Your father was a tax collector? Mm-hmm. I know him as he had something to do with the political party in the early years, and he was doing okay, but then he got in trouble. Yes, he moved to the fashionable adjacent town of Bray. He began his... So this looks like you moved there when you were early part of your life. Let's just check this. Bray. Okay, Joyce's father and paternal grandfather both married into wealthy families. In 1887, his father was appointed rate. That's right, i.e. a local property tax collector. Very good. By Dublin Corporation, the family subsequently moved to the fashionable adjacent small town of Bray. Look at this, Carol. Around this time, Joyce was attacked by a dog, which engendered in him a lifelong canine phobia. I forgot all this stuff. He also suffered from a fear of thunderstorms that his deeply religious aunt had described him as a sign of God's wrath. So he was he was in his first, under 10, right, James? You're talking about being under 10 when all this is happening.
Correct.
Okay, so that's very interesting. Now, the themes in Avatar, besides the dog... And it's like the dog's bray, the braying of the dogs. What would you add about Avatar? Okay, I'm on the right track to say there's a battle between the English, which is the empire, against the oral culture.
Okay, now, looking as you digest the work, which you have thoroughly and those around you have as well, who would be considered the main protagonist of Avatar?
Well, the main protagonist is Jake, the paralyzed soldier.
Right, but he's the bad guy. No, he's the good guy.
Right.
No, he has ulterior motives. Oh, see, that's the whole thing. It's the twist.
Right.
It's the twist.
Yeah, well, probably because, I kind of knew the story, read a bit about it. I knew that he converted, so I wasn't... Someone who knew nothing but the movie might be involved in the drama in the first part. Oh, he's going in on behalf of the general, and he's going to fool them and become an inside agent. But I knew that he was going to convert. So, you know, that's... Hey, Carolyn, did you know that was going to happen, Carolyn?
Yeah, it was pretty obvious. I never read it, but that's, you know, how else could it be?
Yeah, so that's where it's cliche. So you have this cliche pattern, but James is here saying that as you watch this, a person, you can't figure out what their motives are. That's what you're saying, James. And probably that's the way in the Dubliners. Most of the characters, a lot of them are hard to figure out what they think.
Leopold, you didn't have any problem figuring out Leopold, did you?
Right, because you showed all his thinkings in Ulysses.
Exactly, and that's the difference. That's the difference in the work from your avatars, and they tried to blend them, not very successfully, in our opinion. But what do we know?
No, you're right. They tried to show Jake's thinking by his recording his video diary.
Mm-hmm.
But it was very minor, and you didn't get much from it. It was badly done if he was...
It was never developed.
Good point. It definitely wasn't developed. I wouldn't even think of it.
Well, in our day, you didn't get by with such foolishness.
That's right. Well, isn't... In your day, you weren't offering new technical effects. You did, Infinity.
Oh.
You offered...
Really? You think?
No, in the book culture, you created a different prose style with Dubliners. They wouldn't even print it. And
well, history seems to feel a little differently regarding it. They like my work.
No. I'm saying that the technical effect... You did innovate in Ulysses and Finney's Wake. No doubt about that.
Mm-hmm.
You innovated a new thing. So, and that may have been what struck people, and it's what's striking people in this movie, the 3D experience. That's the main attraction. Because it turns out to be pretty cliche otherwise.
Well, much ado about nothing.
Yeah, that's right.
They had the same response when they had, what do you call it, Technicolor?
Right, in the 50s, right. So are you saying that... You're saying that Dubliners and Portrait are innovative, but nothing compared to what you accomplished in Ulysses.
Correct.
You're saying so that Avatar is an immature work, so to speak.
Very good.
Yeah.
Good as it is, but immature. Very good. That's
the
well,
point.
Well, don't worry. They're working on another one, so...
That's right. It
might never fear.
Right, so Dubliners and Portrait Artists are great works, but they are immature compared to your later works, right?
Correct.
So that's the point here. You're saying just like your work, Dubliners, immature, and they fail to show... So in that sense, if it's considered successful, what you show in Leopold Bloom, then Dubliners is really immature because it shows nothing about the people, like the Avatar.
Exactly. You'll start worrying more about typhoid taking your family away than the works that are at hand.
You're saying you worry about the disaster rather than the people's subjective responses.
It's very moving because it'll cause us... It changed us.
What did?
The death of my sisters with the typhoid.
Oh, I didn't know you were referring to... Okay. So we're talking about... How I thought you were saying that because we don't get inside the people, then we're just concerned about their general disaster that's happening.
And the general disaster, you can have personal disasters that can have a more tactile, moving effect on the psyche more than the larger dynamic of saving Fenians from themselves.
No, that's right. Various people died, but there was just nobody really got into it.
Precisely. When there was subjective disdain regarding it, but that was like no big deal.
Yeah, there was subjective disdain about the person dying, but...
Right, it was no big deal.
Right, so you're saying that the death of your sister really affected the family.
And me, yes.
And that, was that portrayed in any way in later writings by you?
Well, it's what gave Leopold a heart.
I see. It was that experience. So, did your sister die before Portrait of the Artist in Dubliners?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yes, and it was all in that time.
Right. But you didn't have a way to deal, and maybe you weren't aware.
To write the words was too painful.
Right. Until many years later when you did Ulysses.
Correct.
So... Is Leopold suffering a tragedy in your perspective?
Well, Mr. Bloom has an internal conflict.
Yes.
He never really gets settled. That's what the whole spin is about.
That's right. No. He doesn't deal with his wife's adultery. He just ends
up... Or the accusation was worse than the act.
Yeah, the accusation with in the neighborhood, in the bar and all that. In other words, he's kind of cowardly. He doesn't...
Well, of course, because it's like, what are you doing it now? You know, you can't even run your own household. How are you going to run the world?
So, and then he goes through all these fantasies as if he is someone great.
Of course.
There's a thing where he becomes the king of Jerusalem or something. I don't remember what part that was, but then there's the whorehouse scene, the brothel scene, and he hallucinates there. And maybe that's when he...
Celebrating those of ill repute.
Right, so In general, this was your criticism of the Irish.
Correct.
They were cowards.
And two-faced.
Right. So why do you think they were that?
So Avatar can have a great protagonist in their movie.
Have a great empire. It builds up the power of the enemy.
Because it's quite a glib plot if you get to it.
A glib plot?
Yes.
Oh, you mean
Avatar?
Well, it's cliche. It's the every plot that's ever was. It's all the star. It's the Empire fights back and those kind of things. It's always fighting the Empire.
Back, yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so the since it's what so you're showing the cowardice in Bloom and the Irish in Ulysses. Is there any reappraisal of that in Finnegan's Wake, or is Finnegan's Wake?
Well, yes, it gets. Then you start spinning a deeper web.
To all of humanity, or still
all
within
of humanity? Yeah. No, all of humanity, because it's the larger dynamic that no one ever seemed to get. I didn't get it, so I can imagine anyone else getting it.
Okay, well, spell out the larger dynamic you thought you didn't, the one you didn't get. What is the larger
dynamic? The synchronicity of how nothing is synchronized.
Oh, the time aspect.
Exactly right.
In other words, everybody's a coward because they're within the concept of time.
Well, and the fear of time, and the fear of retribution, and the fear of time retribution, and the fear of in a hurry, wait.
Right, so one of the key...
It's the eternal conflict. It becomes quite Shakespearean after a bit, does it not?
Yeah, and there's millions of references to Shakespeare in Finnegan's Wake that scholars...
Well, of course, that's your fatalism. That applies. It's to keep you in line. I mean, it's not very effective.
Okay, well, here's what I thought about since talking to Ion and you before. There's a key scene early in the book where the man, which is HCE, here comes everybody, Humphrey Chimpton Earwicker, meets the cad in the park. And it's hard to figure out exactly what happened, but it seems that HCE asked the cad what time it was. And so, therefore, I saw that Joyce understood that you couldn't really determine what time it was, and that was the point of the wake, one of the main points. And that, therefore, Joyce understood that time was the bugaboo.
It is. And that at that point, did time stop, or was that the beginning of the recognition of time? That's the split.
You mean in the story?
That's where the story splits. Was that the beginning of time?
Yeah.
Or is where time began? Or was that the first recollection or noticing of the actuality of what you call time?
You mean the noticing consciously that it's an illusion, or just getting involved in it?
Yes, both.
Yeah,
That's where the story split. We tried to develop both ways. I don't know. Time will tell, as Ion says.
Right, but what you're saying that the two aspects are, is that the moment, is the meeting of the cad, the time when time, the point when time as an illusion, as a trap begins, or is it the point when we recognize time? We notice it as a bit more consciously? Is that the two aspects?
Well, yes, but I have the same problem because I had to have it done by my 40th birthday.
Yeah, that's... Well, no, it started in your 40th birthday, 1922. That's when you started writing it. And unless you're saying, as some people say, that Finnegan's Wake continues themes of Ulysses. And Ulysses was what you got done by your 40th birthday.
Correct. February the 2nd.
Yes. So Ulysses was done. And you look at Finnegan's Wake, it's dated 1922 to 1939. It took 17 years to make. Are you saying that it just continued with the themes of Ulysses?
Well, I quit work on it.
At the moment you began Finnegan's Wake?
Mm-hmm. At my 40th birthday.
You quit work on Ulysses?
Mm-hmm.
It had to be, because you hadn't started.
Correct.
Finnegan's Wake. So you're talking about Ulysses, but the meeting of the cat in the park is in Finnegan's Wake.
Mm-hmm.
So what were you working? You're saying you quit. You didn't quit writing. But you're saying you stopped.
We halted it because I imposed a
arbitrary ending on Ulysses.
Sure.
And so that's what you had to get finished by the time you're 40. So what were you accomplishing after that with Finnegan's Wake? As you worked on it for 17 years, what?
Well, it was just the whole process. There's lots more going on. Because you had to get it into the transition, you had to work into all kinds of problems, and we had a problem with Lucia, and it was a mess.
Okay, so why did you have to finish it by your 40th birthday? Finish your list?
It was just what we made up as our own deadline.
You and the publisher?
No, the publisher was about a non-existence then. It was all but over. We were waiting on then, at that point, we were waiting on the little review. Pick it up.
Yeah, the journal. Well, it was, Ulysses was serialized in the little review a few years before 22. And so that was happening. And then Sylvia Beach presented it to Joyce's 40th birthday, and she published it a few months later. It began there. So the little review
That was minimal because of the Reeve Ghost bookstore.
The Reeve Ghost?
Reeve Ghost was Sylvia's bookstore.
Well, it was called Shakespeare and Company.
No, the bookstore was Reeve Ghost.
Okay, then she changed the name later, I guess.
Correct.
Because it's famous as Shakespeare and Company. Anyways, what's the point of bringing in the bookstore name? Or just the bookstore?
No, you were talking about Sylvia Beach, and we were saying that would have never happened had it not been for Reeve Ghosh. What would have never happened? It would have never been published at all by Sylvia Beach had she not owned Reeve Ghosh Bookstore.
What do you think of that? This is your spontaneous session with James Joyce.
I know, and I was just marveling at all the details.
Like Bray, the little town. Yeah. I remembered it, but I didn't know where it was in Joyce's life, and it would totally fit, because I was looking up in the Wikipedia once he was saying, and Bray was where the little town was, the upper suburb where his father was doing well, tax collecting, and then there was a problem, and then they became poor. Had to move around. And then the fact he got bit by a dog. Now, what's really neat here is James Joyce is talking about the Little Review, which is the magazine that serialized Ulysses. And there was a couple other little facts he threw in there.
Did you look up that Reeve and Ghosh bookstore name?
Yeah, I've stopped it here because for the next 4 minutes, I'm looking up Reeve Ghosh and trying to find out what it is. And that's wastes a lot of time. Basically, Ion points out that that Shakespeare and Company was the publishing name that Sylvia Beach used to publish Ulysses, and because Ulysses became a hit, she changed her bookstore name from Reeve Ghosh to Shakespeare and Company. So I didn't know that little bit. And now the thing is that, and I'm assuming Ion's right there, I haven't checked out whether that's true that Sylvia Beach did that. I do have a book on Sylvia Beach in the library, but the fact the way we're talking about Finney's Wake, he says, well, there were a lot of issues. We had to get it into transition, and that was the magazine that serialized Finnegan's Wake from like 24, 25, 26 on, up until the late 30s. And then he says, and then there was a problem with Lucia. That's when Lucia started to have her disease. So it's totally accurate.
Yeah,
what this James
Joyce.
And
he just threw in these words.
Yeah.
I know. There's no way JW could be saying all that stuff.
Yeah, for anybody who listens this closely, I refer to Jay Joyce. I say, oh, you're James Joyce, but I say JW. I mean James Joyce a little earlier. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to move it forward 4 minutes, and we'll pick up. We get over this research gap where I'm trying to validate what the hell this guy is saying to me. I can't believe he knows these details. It was sprung on me by Ion, this kind of voluntary accuracy. So, I moved it forward 4 minutes. He's talking about his 40th birthday, his deadline is my birthday, Carolyn. That's the incredible thing. He had to get it done before I showed up. February 2nd, 1922 is my birthday, and he's making that a deadline. You know, when I interviewed through the Evergreens, Marshall Duchamp, Marshall McLuhan, Dr. Beter, Christian Murdy, those four guys, Michael Brake Reed's impressions later said that they all resonate with you, Bob. I was sort of like them or something, like Duchamp, McLuhan, Beter, and Christian Murray, personality-wise. So maybe there's a resonance here with Joyce. He knew Bob was coming in his greater
like
being.
Old buddies, you're talking.
And he knew you were coming, too, because you were born that year, but you don't admit that.
Nope.
But the what'd you say? He's talking? What were your words?
You two are talking like old buddies.
Yeah, yeah. So... what did he say that? Yeah, he's saying that the messiness of the avatar, the cheap level, we couldn't get away with that back then as a writer. And he's right. Anyway, you have to realize Joyce was nowhere by 22. And he's saying we're waiting for a little review to publish it. And that wasn't going to happen. And then Sylvia Beach, out of sympathy, did it. Okay, so...
Yeah, there was no big advertising budget or worldwide tour or Google apps.
As soon as it gets published...
or Twitter or Facebook.
Wait a minute. As soon as it gets published, it's banned in the United States.
Which makes it totally wantable.
Yeah, you can't get any sales. All right, so I am saying...
No, it makes it wantable. People...
Oh, yeah, that's a good point. Yeah. But not back then. Nobody knew about it because there was no media coverage.
Right.
All right. So, I mean, back then only, McLuhan used to quote T.S. Eliot, there were only 3,000 people who were keeping up on literature, keeping up on this avant-garde stuff. Okay, so we're beginning here where we're talking about his deadline. Okay.
By the time he's 40.
I set the deadline myself.
Oh, yes, you. Why did you set a deadline?
Because it should have been done. It was enough.
And then you didn't expect it to be published.
Correct.
You thought maybe the little review was posting it and publishing it, some of it anyways.
Well, with the help of John Quinn, but yeah.
You're right about Quinn. Yeah, I know that name. And so it got published in a little review, and then you thought that would be it.
Well, because there wasn't that much interest in it. We couldn't get a publisher until we got Reeve Ghosh.
And Reeve Ghosh...
Sylvia Beach that did publish it under Shakespeare and Company. That was the name of the shop.
Shakespeare and Company. But Reeve Ghosh...
With Reeve Ghosh, Shakespeare and Company was just what it was published under.
Okay.
But if it flopped, it wouldn't hurt Sylvia.
Oh, okay, and Shakespeare and Company did become the name of her bookstore officially later.
After it was a hit.
Oh, okay.
Well, and then after Miss Weaver got screwed.
No, you're right, Miss Weaver. You do know your names. That's great. Let's go into what were you thinking? You wanted to expand with Finnegan's Wake. Yeah, you wanted to get the deeper levels. And you have this.
You had to develop the deeper levels.
Right. So you get this key event of the CAD and the HCE over what is time, what time is it. Now, I would say that is what you didn't overcome. You focused too much on time and the conventional understanding of time and wrestle against it, and that's what you didn't solve. Because you worked within the problem.
Correct.
Now, I understand through the Evergreens you had a problem with Einstein, and this guy saying... talking about time and E equals MC squared, and you thought, it's silly to have this little formula seem to explain everything.
Uh-huh.
And you seem to want to illustrate other levels that maybe Einstein could have been developed to.
Well, they left off the... Well, it's just like with Tom's Directory, and then you go on into classical mythology. It was never, ever, ever opened that it was... The Einstein world didn't fit in Homer's Odyssey.
That's what you're requiring it to fit into Homer's Odyssey. And
correct.
If it doesn't, then
you can't get there.
Yeah, no, I know Tom's Directory, THOMS. That's the key source
all
you
participants
used.
Are now muted.
What was the other thing you said? Maybe it was just Homer. Tom's Directory.
Well, the classical mythology.
Yeah, classical. So. The C.S. Lewis later wrote about the split between the sciences and the humanities. You're saying if you're going to have a formula, you got to include the classical humanity literacy heritage. So you take on Einstein and his obsession with time, and you both were duped by that dilemma of time.
Absolutely.
Right, and there it is. But at least you made a good run at it and knew there was more involved in time than people were assuming.
Well, it became more time less as time went on. So good.
Right. Now, you did you had you ever heard of, now we when I talked to you last on March 22nd, 2009, we didn't know about riff riding really. Had you heard of such phenomena, parallel worlds?
Yes.
And did you go to Gypsies to get in touch with it? That was a different motive.
It was a different motive, but it activated lots of other folks like Samuel Beckett later on, Flann O'Brien. There were lots. Robert Wilson. There were lots that were moved into that, what they're calling now. We had no idea that it would come to this then, but a modernist movement. But it allowed them to actually take literal theory and bring it into the innovation that allowed parallelism as an elementary particle.
Right. Now, when you start off saying it influenced Beckett, I didn't know whether you meant the going to the Gypsies or your interest in parallel worlds. I think you mean parallel worlds.
In parallel worlds, that's correct.
Yeah, Robert Anton Wilson. He's the one who brought in a lot of the physics blatantly, you know.
And another one was a little of Joseph Campbell, but not quite so much.
Yeah, no, this is very good. This person I'm talking to, it really has a good knowledge of James Joyce's world. So I'm assuming, because you are the guy. You are James Joyce. And this is coming through clearer than March 22nd, because I'm a different person in relation to I am now, I think. Wouldn't you say?
That's absolutely correct.
Right, so where's... What's that little beep? The funny beep over on the phone. Maybe that's recording. Maybe that sometimes our phone records some of these messages for some reason. Okay.
There's a beep.
Beg your pardon?
There's your beep.
We had one. We didn't have one right when you said it. Why are you saying there's your beep?
We just had another beep.
Oh, okay. Oh, that's my beep. No, but there was, unless I'm hallucinating, there seemed to be a stronger beep coming from the speakerphone. Because occasionally... our speakerphone records parts of these sessions. We don't know why that happens. And that may be that beep, not the one just now, the larger beep.
Wait for it. Here it comes. Ready? Get ready. Okay. Almost ready. Hold on.
There it is.
There we go.
Yeah. So maybe I missed her. I thought it was the speakerphone, but it was this phone. Okay. So staying on this point, how would you have figured out or have an intuition of parallel worlds? How would you have heard about that?
Well, it's very simple. I didn't. I just got to the dynamic, and libations helped me more than anything.
Right, and drugs, other kinds of drugs.
Of course. Well, there wasn't such a thing in those days. They were remedies.
That's
they
right.
Were drugs. They were remedies.
Okay, I'm just going to... all right, so... okay, so, well, let me just change my phone. Get rid of the beep. Just a second.
Well, your phone won't do it. What you're going to need to do is take a moment of refreshment, redial, and that'll take care of it.
Oh, it's more JW's beep?
No, it's your beep, but you'll need to make a new connection.
Okay, I'm going to hang up and then change my battery and then call you. Okay.
Very wonderful.
Okay, here we go.
Okay, so we stopped there, and we did around phoning, so I move it forward a minute or two so we can pick up where then we get rehooked up.
And it's back to us again. You'll have to settle first to the old Ion.
Ion is saying that when I recalled Carolyn, we're now talking to Ion, so we have to bring Joyce back in. So just for you listeners, this is what's going to happen here. I want to get Joyce back. I don't want to just talk to Ion.
And James said to tell you that the Aloysius came from him.
I'm going to rewind it just slightly. Okay, right there.
And it's back. back to us again. You'll have to settle for silly old Ion. And James said to tell you that the Aloysius came from his great uncle.
Okay, well, we can't bring him back in?
Sure.
Yeah, I want to continue. We're just beginning. So let's, I request James, Mr. Joyce to continue talking to us.
Okay.
All right, so I've got... Okay, so we're... Okay, so your interest in parallel worlds, does that make you wonder about time?
Well, it makes you question time and the illusion of it.
And because...
That's why I got so tangled up in the wake.
That's right.
Accessing of time.
Yeah, and because you didn't become a parallel worlder and never got direct experience of it to figure it out, that's why you remain stuck in wrestling with it as a concept.
Seemed to be Thaddeus' problem too, didn't it?
Thaddeus, who was that?
Oh, Bob. We thought you'd actually read the work.
You mean Phineas Wake or Thaddeus? I've heard the name Thaddeus before, but are you talking about Thaddeus' work or Thaddeus?
No, Thaddeus in the Wake.
Okay, well, I don't recall that immediately. I never thought of it much, Thaddeus. But I'm going to put in Thaddeus with the instant Phineas Wake here known as Wikipedia. St. Thaddeus? Thaddeus is a man's given name. Is most likely derived from the Aramaic word meaning breast, which would be a nickname for a close friend, as in bosom buddy. Okay, so now, are there any famous Thaddeuses? There is, you know what's interesting, there's no obvious Thaddeus in Phineas Wake, but it is T-H-A and then Deus, which is God. So the God, Phineas Wake ends with T-H-E, then the book becomes the God. So Tales of Distance echoes the relationship between Arlene and Thaddeus, okay? Phineas Wake episode, okay. I can go to my Phineas Wake index and evoke all the references to Thaddeus. There just seems to be one happening. Just bear with me here. You have no time, so we all have all the time.
Well, and then you got, and also I think you may be pulling it into Telemucius.
Telemaeus?
No, Mucius.
Okay.
It's Palin, Bob. Palin. Vera Palin.
Is she? She's a metaphor for what we're talking about in some
That's
way.
That's right, in Penelope.
She's the new B-grade avatar. She's the Jake Sully, the guy in Avatar. Okay, just a second. I'm looking up the Finnegan's Wake link. So, because I can just, it's very good. It'll show me all the references to Thaddeus. Just hold. Okay, here it is. So I write in Thaddeus. I get a feeling it's not used too much. Stan Finnegan's Wake. We got two quotes. Page 246. Choice of her lies between Josephinus and Maria Lewis for who is to wear the lily of Bohemie, Florestan, Thaddeus, Hardress, or Miles, and lead raptivity captive, ready like a fin at a fair. And then the other one, page 456, it's how I'll try and collect my extra professional postages owing to me by Thaddeus Kelly Esquire, director for non-desirable printed matter. The Jukes and the Kelly Cooks have been, and then it carries on. So, and now what was the other word you were just mentioning?
pronounced it differently, but telemacious.
Is that T-E-L-E-M-A something? What would come after
T-H-U-S.
Oh, yeah, Telemachus. That's the name of one of the chapters in Ulysses.
Mm-hmm.
So, but
I don't know. Those are the empirical reference. And sorry, you were cheating because you had your little plastic box. We wanted to see if you were as close to this work as you pronounced to be.
Well, Telemachus, if you had said it the way I understand it, I know that's a chapter in Finnegan's Wake. I think it's the first chapter. It's the beginning. It's the sun. There is no use of T-E-L-E-M-A-C-H-U-S in Finnegan's Wake. And McLuhan used to point out that it's interesting what Joyce leaves out.
Uh-huh. Very good. And if you got the girth of the work, then we have another question for you, since you're the student extraordinaire this evening. If the light of day was an example in Ulysses, what was Finnegan's Wake?
Well, obviously Ulysses is the day, and Finnegan's Wake is a book of the night. So the light of day, so I'd have to come up with a cliche about the fear of night, or the darkness of night, or the veil of tears. I don't...
The differential. The differential. There you go. You actually got it. Very good. The difference between the night and day.
Right. It's the interval between the two. Well, there is a difference.
And that interval is the whole dynamic of the problem with time that I never even figured out.
Right. See, that's why McLuhan was a parallel worlder, according to Ion. So he understood, and that's why he could find clarity in Finnegan's Wake where neither you or anybody else did, because he saw what you were reaching toward. Okay?
Reaching for, and we like to say, alluding to.
Yes, and so when one understands what McLuhan understood, then Finnegan's Wake is pretty obvious.
It is, and we didn't have a problem with it, except that it was what we called a wonderful work that nobody understood. Oh, but they'd preach the tunes of T.S. Eliot. Oh, my goodness, and they understood that, and that was a bunch of gobbledygook.
That's right. So just go back. Telemachus is a figure in Greek mythology, the son of Odysseus, the son of Ulysses.
Of course.
Right, so Finnegan's Wake is Telemachus, in a sense. It's the son of Ulysses, and a central character in Holmes' Odyssey. Now,
Homer.
Sorry, what did I say, Home? Okay, now
yeah.
I'm just going to just check.
Palin.
Yeah. Home is Palin?
No. Yes, home is to Homer, as Palin is to Palin.
Okay, so, yeah, see, Telemachus is episode one.
Yes.
And it's about Stephen, the son. The
correct.
Metaphorical son of Lippo Bloom. So,
and the interplay with Miss Emily.
Is Miss Emily, who's Miss Emily? Is she in the book? Or we don't know who Miss Emily is.
Emily Bloom, Bob?
No, it's Molly.
No. What was her middle name?
Okay, we'll check that.
And if they left that out of the translations, I'm going to start screaming.
Okay, so Telemachus, if Ulysses begins with the chapter called Telemachus, and then the after effect of Ulysses is Finney's Wake, which is the sun, so it becomes circular. You know, Finney's Wake is back
exactly,
to the first chapter.
Exactly. And that's why we understood how people picked up Finnegan's Wake and didn't understand it when they didn't bother to look at Ulysses to get the beginning place. You couldn't get there without one without the other.
That's right. And, okay, so Molly, who...
But they couldn't get linked together because it wasn't a good enough work, apparently.
Yes, that's right. It was too messy and nobody knew it. Nobody got it. And, just for McLuhan to talk about it in the 40s, where it wasn't even allowed to be read by students, that was pretty avant-garde on his part, to claim that there was some usefulness in it. You know? So it says Molly Bloom is a...
Jabberwocky, the very idea. idea.
Motley Bloom is a fictional character. The major, she corresponds to Penelope in the Odyssey. The major difference between Molly and Penelope is that while Penelope is eternally faithful, Molly is not. Having an affair with you blazes boiling. Joyce modeled the character upon his wife, Nora Barnacle. Molly, whose given name is Marion, was born in 1870. They do not give her middle name.
So we talk, and I look up Emily, and I don't find anything, and I just we drop it. And then I realize later, well, that's maybe Joyce from another James Joyce. See, it doesn't necessarily have to be the James Joyce that we think wrote the book. There could be other Joyces who did the book in different ways, in other worlds.
Little Emily, who was Little Emily?
Molly Bloom.
Right, oh. Okay, so it's not based on any real person named Emily or Emmeline or anything.
Correct.
Okay, so you have this wrestling with time. And see, Joyce is here's a good way to look at Finnegan's Wake. It's the last book, the last novel. It remains immortal.
The unfinished work.
Beg your pardon?
The unfinished work.
Yeah, in the postmodern sense that anybody can write a book in the 20th century, so anybody can write it. And so Finnegan's Wake leaves the ending open, inviting anybody to carry on being a writer. But
okay.
Since it's a clown. But no, let me just say the issue.
No, wait a second. Okay. Hold on. If you take Finnegan's Wake and you read the last chapter, okay, and you get to the V at the very end,
yeah,
and then you go right back to Ulysses, they'll circle.
Yeah, if you go to Ulysses, not Finnegan's Wake.
Correct.
Yes, I actually have discovered that. I forget how you...
Very few have.
That's right. Can you say that I discovered it? Do you know that I discovered that?
Well, we wouldn't have pointed it out.
Okay, very good. Because I'm...
Very timeless of you there, Bob.
So I wanted to say this idea that in Finnegan's Wake, his last book... Hey, Carolyn, you better mute Carolyn. In Finnegan's Wake is the last book... The end of the Gutenberg era, and McLuhan liked to refer to Pope's The Dunciad, which was the latest version of what was a book that that dealt with the effects of the printing press. So here is Joyce saying the printing press is losing its effect because new media are transcending it. But anyways, you're giggling at that. I just want to say that if Finnegan's Wake is the last book, and the printing press... Gutenberg really rubbed in the false premise of time. Then it's interesting that you have the last book, the last great book of the Gutenberg era, what McLuhan called the Gutenberg galaxy, wrestling with time and the effect that time was created by the Gutenberg galaxy. It's actually totally appropriate that the Wake is wrestling with time because the Wake is a book. It's trapped inside the book effect, and it's wrestling with the most hidden false premise in the book effect, time, and doesn't get over it because it's still being a writer.
And here's how we were...
Carolyn, mute, please. Please, hey, Carolyn, you're mute. Okay, go ahead.
And here's what we were trying to actually exacerbate in this whole process. In the light of the day, you know how you're going in the process of your daylight time.
Yes.
You can follow the sun. Well, at night, you don't know how long the night is. The night is unknown to you. In the day of shadows, you never can gauge your proximity of night.
The day of shadows referring to the dream life when you're asleep.
Correct. Very good.
Yeah, and you can't gauge what time it is or anything.
That's exactly correct.
Yeah, and you don't know how long you've been asleep unless you trust the clock.
Well...
But you don't have an experience of time.
Correct.
You might experience dreams, but if science looks at it, those dreams happen for 3 seconds or something.
Exactly. Precisely. Yeah. Very good. Yeah. And that was the interplay that we were trying to nail home. Is that the way?
Yeah. Now, this is the important part, the interplay. I've always pondered about how did you get into the idea of the interplay? You know, how did you discover that? How did you know that's what McCoy...
Not a scotch, Bob.
Not a scotch. Oh, the kiln's pointing at something. What kiln?
The moon and the star.
Yeah, the star is probably James Joyce right beside it looking at us. But the... Yeah, a lot of scotch and getting into the subjectivity of experience and time, like you...
Well, the tactility of time. You asked someone about time in my day, and they didn't know. You had to trust to whomever you were engaging as the relegated time. They didn't know time either. It was a new concept, Bob, in my day. You didn't worry about what time it was.
That's right. The industrialization of time was just beginning, just after your early days, I guess, right?
Well, correct.
I mean, that's when Ford, the assembly line, and that kind of industrial factory life started to come in while you were alive, but not when you were young.
And everyone in my day owned clocks, but there wasn't two of them that said the same time at the same time.
Okay, so it was... people were not fanatic about having precise time.
That is exactly correct.
So you see the rigidification of time? You saw that happening in your life?
It did.
And that was a problem. Okay, so we like to say the printing press started to lock people into time, but not everybody read for a couple hundred years, and then by the 1800s, a lot more people are reading, so they're getting into the book effect. But you're talking about industrialization really having a major effect.
Right.
Yeah, and that was the new phenomenon for...
About the synchronicity, and so they synchronized it, or did they?
Right.
Then you go back to the wake, and you find out they didn't.
That's right. So you said in interviews that Finning's Wake was written the way it was because it's in the language of dream, or it's a dream language. Mm-hmm. And the dream language should be tied to the issue of time, and definitely, like when you're drunk, when you're asleep, there's no time. So yeah, that's a metaphor. So we move into more and more daylight in the action of Finnegan's Wake, because if daylight is the symbol for knowing exactly what time it is, not exactly, but you get a little more time orientation during the day.
The stretch, but yeah, Bob.
So the CAD incident probably happens at night when he asks what time it is. When he meets the CAD in the park, it's probably... They would know what time it was.
Late dusk.
Right. Okay, so you wrestled with time, and when you transitioned, you felt the bliss of eternity. Mm-hmm. Did you continue to think about your book, or that kind of thinking would not be thought?
No, that was our life's work, Bob. That was the ending of an era, and it stands. And you're still speaking of it today. That's why we're able to come and visit with you about it now, because now it's all clear. We were right.
Right. Now
that's significant, because in those days it was much more important to be right than happy.
That's right. That's correct. But you were
judged by your veracity of correctness.
Right. No, I want to go into a bit more, but we brought up, how, did you think about your book once you transitioned, or is that kind of thinking not an issue in the contrastless zone?
Well, think about it. We reveled in it, that we were validated. And the validation was Finnegan's Wake, without any contrast, becomes the perfect explanation.
That's right. So the...
Without contrast. But now if you add contrast to it, then you get betwixt and between yourself, don't you?
Yeah, so when you experience no time in the non-physical, you recognize that's what I was getting at.
Correct.
And then you knew you were right. And then what's interesting, Dull and Nurse ends with the dead. And if you think of yourself as dead when you transition, you were predicting your own realization once you were dead.
And in our looping synchronicity, the beginning.
Yes. So have you not gone to the Guff because there's so much interest in the wake and that holds you here?
Well, others would pick up on that place of question that could develop it. And that's just not been our experience.
Because the whole premise was not correct. I mean, you got it right. You got it right in the book, but you did not. That was an accident if you connected to James Joyce's mind, because James Joyce didn't know what he was doing, correct?
Of course.
But in the book, I
still don't.
The book got it. Yeah, you still don't?
Still don't, but we don't care now.
Yeah. Okay, so Finney's Wake got it right, and that's what we're talking about. And nobody got that. But I think McLuhan started to, because he said, he liked your phrase, the heliotropical no time, on page 349 of our Finnegan's Wake, not your Finnegan's Wake, because a lot of yours got cut out, as you said back in March 22nd. But our Finnegan's Wake, heliotropical no time, you're showing the no time, you're showing the interval and all that stuff. And McLuhan saw that that would be the effect of living under electric conditions. We'd be living in a no time. So he applied it to that practical level, but I think you were more interested in the metaphysical situation of time, or the concept of it.
The way the calipers applied, as in page 472 from your version.
Yes, do you want me to check that by putting in page 472 to see if that's on?
Please yourself, Bob.
Yeah, are you saying calipers is on page 472?
Well, we're saying that the way it was calibrated, the calipers of calibration of no time,
right,
was developed more on 472.
Right, not the word calipers. So
right,
if I put in, I don't have my Finnegan's Wake right here. I could get page 472, though. I think I used to like that page because it was 4 and 7/11 time. 22 times 2 makes finish. And there were some other things on that page. So it'd be good to bring up that page and see if we can. James Joyce is Finnegan's Wake. Nah, it didn't do it. Okay, but if I go 142, if we can get 142.
472.
Sorry, 472. 304, okay, this might work. 354. Okay. It's a short page.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense? 473. No, it can't be. Okay, I think it's not the last page of a chapter. Okay, but I'm going to go with what this shows. It shows, agreed, woo Welsher. He was shug-filled to be sate on urn as in hiving of fox-told conningnesses, but who, hey honey, for all values of his ladders, integrity most, was the foremost of the firm. At folk mood hailed, at part farewailed, aquinolated con cloud, noir noir, knee bob of Nephilim. Now, we like that phrase. We've been doing a lot on the Nephilim with Ion. After all, what followed for apprentice sake, since the now nighs nearing as the yeast hies hind. There it is. The now nighs nearing.
Absolutely. And once you come to where we gain, we lie in the place of disdain.
Right. I just want to say that Ion is often going, now, no, no, now, no, no, here it is, now, get ready, now. It's like you're dealing with now as it nears, and you keep trying to pin it. Now, who just said the word disdain, Ion or Joyce?
Joyce.
And what were you disdaining?
The whole point of this non-time, timing, time of time.
Right, so...
the untimely time.
Yes, and then it says, GB's, ugh, kek, pata, that was an ill man. Jaboos, putty good, this is for true a Swedish man. But Jumbluffer, begad, sir, yon would be for a once over our all-honored Christ-mistied Easter man. fourth position of solution.
Mm-hmm.
Would that be referencing the fourth ring?
Mm-hmm.
How, Johnny? Finest view from horizon. Tableau final. To me see. Male and female unmask we hem. The gum by gun. Who now brews old brawn? Dawn! Now that would be the light.
It would, what your eye on calls the event horizon.
Right, exactly. The nape of his name shielder scalp, help, after having drummed all he'd done. Hun, worked out to an inch of his core. More, ring down. While the queen bee, he stagger horned, blesses her bliss for to feel her funny man's functions tag, rumbling. Then it says, tears, tears, and tears, rounds. That's an important sentence, I think. Tears, tears, and tears. Now, this is end. So, yeah, I think the next chapter begins in 473. So, tears and tears.
That was it. The above it was the point.
The tears, tears, tears? And
No. Earlier.
Yeah, the now's nearing.
Mm-hmm.
And that is what you were trying to show.
In the interplay of timeless time.
All right. Here's what's... When I read McLuhan on the word tactile, and you do have the word tactile not too often in Finnegan's Wake.
Well, we weren't trying to be that salacious, Bob. Tactile in those days was something you ran from.
That's right. In the Bernard Berenson... No. It was the art critic Wolfland. He did a whole book on the form of art or the form of something like that. And he's the one who popularized the concept of tactility. Were you aware of that, of Wolfland's work?
Marginally.
So that is not where you got the idea of the tactile?
Correct.
Okay, so what did you mean by tactile? Ion means contrast with the word tactile.
We meant as a, if you took a block and tickle and you tried to raise an element that was larger than the block and tickle could lift, the strain of that dispersal of energy to raise the thing heavier than the block and tickle would raise, that was tactility.
It wouldn't the block and tackle break?
It would, finally, or at least would hold or bind, cause pressurization to the point that you would take it to task. That was the tactility.
So tactility was the tension of the moment when you were overextending something.
Deciding if it would or would not raise.
Oh, okay. So that is what you meant by tactile, and people ran from that?
Well, they did, because if it broke, somebody could get hurt, you see.
Right.
Tactility in my day was always the straw that broke the camel's back.
All right, so is tactility a key metaphor in Finnegan's Wake?
Certainly.
It's the tension between past, present, and future?
It's the tension between the human creator playing with the no conceptual view of no time.
Right. Yeah, the tension for the labyrinth of the mind and its rules.
Absolutely, to embrace it.
Right, that's the
thing. Or not, exactly.
And you could crack. You could get hurt.
That's right. Or you could see that it wasn't going to raise and ease off the pressure. Well, that was then releasing or being relieved from tactility.
Right.
Good.
So tactility, it's not just the interval between light and darkness. It's a proprioceptive strain in existence.
Certainly, the pressure, pressurization, good.
Right, it's what you rub up, you might, maybe when you disconnect from non-physical, you create a weird kind of tension. Then you crack under that and really disconnect, or you release and go back. So the metaphor of tactility is the waxing and waning, but it's not just romantic waves come in and go out. It's a very tense tension.
Absolutely.
Are you getting any discount?
Mm-hmm.
It's very good. Very interesting. So that is the risk of coming forth and creating in the physical. you experience the tactile tension between the non-physical and the physical. And whether you're going to go back into the non-physical or not, or balance it, in relation to the tension that you have with others who are creating at the same time. You know, McLuhan had a phrase, he quoted, the strain of civilization. So you could take this tension that's always in consciousness and then show the ratios, how tension services in different cultures according to their language and culture. Would you agree with that?
Certainly, it's also what holds your little piece of dirt together as a planet.
It's really what gravity is.
Pretty much, yeah.
Yes, and electromagnetism. So you would relate it to physics principles and say, this is what they're trying to describe.
Yeah, Jabberwocky.
Right, science was Jabberwocky. And who did Jabberwocky? That was the Catholic guy that McLuhan liked in the 19th century. Forgot him. Let me just Google that, because he's a name I shouldn't forget. Jabberwocky was the one who started to break up words. He's a good model for later Joyce. But very childish compared to what McLuhan was talking, or Joyce was talking. Oh, Lewis Carroll. That's right. No, I was thinking of the dappled poet. Who's the guy? The dappled dap.
We kind of got quiet because we thought, Mott Land stars about it. He's got to have his plastic bugs for that. We're in trouble.
Yeah, no, that is. This is what Ion has made me very forget a lot of time. I've forgotten a lot of. I knew more than I've forgotten, or whatever the phrase is. I forgot more than you guys will ever know.
You got to remember to forget what you forgot to remember.
Yeah, no, I mean, this is ridiculous. I can't remember the dappled guy. You know, the 19th century poet who first started to play. Geez, that's really bad. And then to forget that fucking Lewis Carroll did it. Now, Lewis. Because Lewis Carroll is someone who's featured a lot in Finnegan's Wake.
Of course.
And you're not impressed? You're not impressed with Lewis Carroll? Is that what you're getting
no.
at?
No. Correct. It was the end for the means, not the means for the end.
Right. Now, what is that guy? I'm going to have to just put British Catholic poet, because I can't go on without remembering this guy, because he was an interesting list of Catholic. British Catholic. Okay, this might give us something. If I had my library handy, I could cheat. Check it out. List of Catholic authors. There it is, Gerard Manley Hopkins. Okay, Gerard Manley Hopkins. That's what I thought was... did he have any influence on you? Because he started... The reason McLuhan goes into Lewis Carroll and Stephen Mallarmé... Mallarmé and the symbolists would break up the alphabet, which was radical. And Gerard Manley Hopkins was one of those that started to break up poetic rhythm or something. Lewis Carroll would just be playing with the concept of time and miss the linguistic implications of the symbolists. Were you influenced by the symbolists, as McLuhan said you were, Stephen Mallarmé?
A bit. It was all a blur.
It was all a blur, right? I mean, you touched and read and dipped into things. So is there someone that people say Vico was a big influence on you, Blavatsky, all of the many authors. Is there someone that we all missed, or the scholars missed? Or there was no influence on you, probably is the best way to say it.
Well, there was no one that was a significant influence, but you understand we were trying to go beyond what had been done. So there was much influence about me, around me, that I used as the interplay to lay the foundation for even for the simplest of works.
Right, but one of the main immediate influences was Einstein. You didn't like this attention on Einstein.
Absolutely.
Right. And And Lewis Carroll, some people think that you admired Carroll or that was important, but what was it that Lewis Carroll was missing in Jabberwocky and Through the Looking Glass?
The dynamic of the split between the fairy world and the fairy land. He divided fairy world from fairy land, and it wasn't that way.
And you knew that much?
Absolutely.
So if you couldn't figure out time, that would have been a European culture, industrial European culture coming to Ireland, because you didn't, and that was late in Dublin, so you guys grew up without time, so to speak. Mm-hmm. But the fairy world, the Irish are experts in. So did you see fairies, know of their existence?
Certainly.
And that's because you grew up with it. I mean,
well, everyone has their favorite leprechaun, Bob.
And you could see them.
Absolutely.
So you found Europeans in Paris quite odd? No, I'll do it this way. When you go to Italy, that's where you go first, spend 10 or more years teaching English there, according to the record. May not be true. Did you find Italians very different from you?
Certainly.
So you always were an outsider in relation to
them. They had no ethics. They weren't based on anything.
But they were supposed to be Catholics, strong Catholics, I guess. But they were they kind
of... Hey, if there hadn't been so much communion going on, not many of them would have been Catholic, we can assure you that.
They enjoyed the drinking.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Ian's talking about the Italians here, just so you know. This is what
James Joyce used to live there.
Yeah, James Joyce lived in Italy after he left Dublin, in Trieste. This is just leading into new stuff, and this was said on Tuesday, but just so you know, he's talking about the Italians. He didn't find them worthy or something.
Were they cowardly like the Irish?
No, they were hot-headed.
Yes.
Rather than interact, they always had a found a tendency or way to overreact.
Right. Now, I found that when I went to Italy, and I look at myself. So I consider myself a pretty balanced person. Did you consider yourself a balanced person? In other words, you weren't going to get hot-headed. You weren't going to be cowardly. Or were you all those things?
No, it was all inside. You dealt with it inside.
Yeah, you kept it inside yourself. You were kind of had decorum in public.
Mm-hmm. No, of course it's called proper to be proper.
But the Irish, they were not proper. They were cowardly. They thought they were proper and all that.
That's how they got their strength, was by keeping their mouth shut.
Right, so what you mean by proper is not a Puritan thing, but keeping your cool.
Correct, your decorum. Decorum is the better part of valor.
All right, so I think I'm that kind of person. I keep my cool, and I find natural characteristics are extreme, or different peoples are extreme. They don't keep their cool, but there are individuals in Italy and individual Irish who keep their cool. There was a man named James Stevens who, the story is, you thought he should take over writing Finnings Wake 1929 or 1930.
Never.
Why do we think that you did ask him to do it?
Well, we asked a lot of people to do a lot of things.
I see.
He got much more full of himself than we ever were. He thought more of himself than we did.
Right. And I thought that, well, I took that as a fact, and I thought, well, Finnegan's Wake is like editing a newspaper, so anybody can take over the role of gathering information and mutating along the principles that Joyce...
And yet you still don't get it, so good luck with that.
Right. You did not see yourself as miming the editor of a newspaper.
Never.
I would personally... say that when talking about Finn's Way, I would ignore you.
You have the right to be wrong.
That's right. I have the right to play with the weight the way I want to throw
it
aside.
Oh, certainly, yes. Yeah. Now, that's great fun. That's the great fun. That's
what George McLuhan did. He had great fun.
Absolutely. Marshall was, he did better than anyone.
That's right, with
tearing it apart, but then putting it back together. Anybody can tear something up, Bob, but very few can put it back together.
Yeah, he did that. He put it together. So
very eloquently.
Yeah, so now, so we're looking at, is there, was there a disappointment that Beckett didn't marry Lucia? Lucia, I don't know how you pronounce her name, your daughter. There was supposedly a possible relationship there. Did that upset Lucia?
Certainly.
That was a major disruptor.
Thing, of course.
Right.
There was honor involved that had been breached.
Right, and did you know about that?
Yes.
And so that caused a division or a strain between you and Beckett?
Of course.
So is that a factor in Lucia's madness?
Her mind just slipped away, Bob. It was a beginning place, and she got further and further and further away.
And then, yeah, Beckett was a beginning place.
Yeah.
The shock of having hope for so much more, and then it doesn't happen.
Well, but then she just basically, you looked in her eyes, and she was no longer there.
Because she was so shocked, traumatized by what Beckett had done.
Well, we won't give him that much power, but it certainly was a straw that broke the camel's back. I think we spoke of that before.
Right.
And it moved it into a whole disdain. It disrupted the whole family.
Right. Now, was Beckett aware that he had that strong of an influence?
We never exposed it that way.
Right. Because there is a book where
you don't display your insane in the front of the house. You keep them in the back.
Right. So, and then the insane meaning what you actually dealt with when you were privately with Lucia. Not that she's insane, but just what, how you thought about her.
She just drifted away. She just drifted away.
So you do
always mean, loving, always loving, but she just drifted away.
Right, and when you say you don't keep the insane, you kept Lucia in the back? You don't?
Yeah.
Okay. So the... There was a book written a few years ago in the Joyce Scholarship World that Lucia had incredible influence on you.
Which children do you don't love?
Right, but it had, I didn't read the book, but I read a review or two, and it implied she was quite creative and did funny things with paintings or writings or something, mm-hmm. and they gave Joyce you ideas. Would you agree with that?
Not ideas, the joy of when she would spend just days and days and days and days and days on painting a blade of grass.
And
it was beautiful, but it was a blade of grass.
And that, her ability to focus and be involved in something, that was inspiring to you.
Just countless thousands of brushstrokes on a blade of grass. was delicious because you got the shearing up of the reality of action without the concept or knowing within your being mind.
Right. Now, why is there references to television in Finnegan's Wake?
Because we experienced it.
Right. It was not that available. How did you personally experience it?
Well, that was easy. There were friends who had access to the little box, and you could go listen to the show on the box. Didn't have a picture yet, but it was just a matter of time.
You mean you could listen to radio?
We watched the radio.
Ah, you couldn't see the picture, though.
And then your work with Tesla in the day might have been seeming a little bit science fiction in my neighborhood.
Yeah.
But it was very clearly demonstrated that it was as though it was before it was ever created.
You mean television?
Yeah.
So you were aware of Tesla's work?
Certainly.
Did he influence whatever you heard about his experiments or products? That made you think, that helped you think about non-time?
Absolutely, because you got to remember, we were in the revolution that had electric lights.
That's right.
they remembered when there were none, and then all of a sudden they were.
And
so it was quite a radical thing. We didn't care much about it, but to not have to trim the wick, was pretty significant.
And how does Tesla relate to the electric light experience?
Tesla had a way of putting electricity through the ground that would allow everybody to have movies, what you call on-demand.
Yeah.
Shows would be made available to entire communities, and not from a broadcast standpoint, from a what you call a podcast element.
Yes.
From the tower that would be made available. It was astounding.
Yeah, and so you heard about... you heard about Tesla's work. That's interesting. And that he did Planet the Light
Bulbs. Everybody did, Bob.
That's right. He was quite well known in his day. When he put the light bulbs in Colorado or someplace in the ground, right?
No, it was actually the World's Fair.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay. He did it there.
And illuminated all the World's Fair for the first time.
Do you know which World's Fair that was?
1909, I guess.
Okay. I'm put the word tactile. It only shows up once in Finnegan's Wake.
Yes.
Page 478, it says, "So, Kluver, a truce to your trifling, where are you?" Then someone says... Trifling, yeah. Then someone says, "Trinathan Partnick Dudenay, have you seen her? Typette, my tactile O." Then someone else says, "Are you and your fatherick, lonely one?" Then someone says, "The same, three persons. Have you seen my darling only? My tactile O." So the O is an image of tension?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the circular tension.
Mm-hmm. With the block and tackle.
Right. I don't see... So the book, Finnegan's Wake, is in a circle, so that's tactile tension.
Of course.
And a block and tackle is circular, I guess. You're pulling on a thing.
Right. It's a set of circles that has the rope through it that displaces and defies gravitational assertion of force.
So maybe if I look at the image on page 293, that might have a reference to block and tackle. That's a major image that you're using.
Mm-hmm.
Right, a major example.